This is chapter 15 of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. With this orientation of thought, I studied optics as presented by physics, but I had to reject much of it. The ideas I arrived at, however, paved the way to Goethe's theory of color. This in turn opened the door to his scientific writings. First, I showed Schroer some of the shorter expositions I had written, which were based on my views of science. He did not make much of them. I had not yet worked them out to harmonize with Goethe's views, but toward the end I had added a short remark. Quote, Goethe's research will be given proper credit among scientists only when it becomes possible to consider nature from this perspective. Unquote. It pleased Schroer tremendously when I expressed such views, but he never went beyond that. This will illustrate my situation. One day Schroer told me of his conversation with a colleague who was a physicist. The man had said, quote, Goethe opposed Newton, yet Newton was such a genius. Schroer replied, quote, but Goethe was also a genius, unquote. Once again I felt entirely alone in my struggle with this enigma. It seemed to me that the ideas I gained about optics built a bridge between what spiritual insight reveals and the results of scientific research. I felt the need to experiment with optics in my own way, to test, through physical experience, the thoughts I had developed on the nature of light and color. It was not easy for me to purchase what I needed for such experiments. I earned barely enough from my tutoring to accommodate my needs. But I did all I possibly could to test the theory of light, which would provide a truly unbiased understanding of the natural facts in this field. I knew very well from my work in Reitlinger's laboratory how these tests were usually done by the physicists. I was familiar with the mathematical formulas applied to optics because I had recently studied intensively in exactly that field. Despite all objections by physicists against Goethe's theory of color, my own experiments drove me increasingly toward Goethe's views and away from the usual views of physicists. I became aware that all the usual experiments merely reconstruct facts, quote, about light, unquote, to use Goethe's expression, and not experiments, quote, with light, unquote, itself. I told myself, colors do not, as Newton believed, come from light. Colors appear when light encounters obstacles to its own free development. It seemed to me that this could be seen directly from the experiments. This proved to me that light does not belong to actual physical entities. It presents itself as a stage between reality that is tangible to the senses and reality that is spiritually perceptible. I was not inclined merely to philosophize about these things, but placed great value on a factual reading of nature. And it became increasingly clear to me that light itself does not enter the sphere of the physically perceptible, but remains beyond that sphere. Colors, on the other hand, appear when something perceptible to the senses is placed into the world of light. This caused me to study the natural sciences again from every possible direction. I began afresh to study anatomy and physiology. I studied the forms of the parts of human, animal, and plant organisms. This led me in my own way to Goethe's theory of metamorphosis. I became increasingly aware how the picture of the physical world, tangible to the senses, related to what I saw spiritually. When I observed with spiritual perception the soul activity of the human being, thinking, feeling, and willing, a picture of the spiritual human became clearly perceptible to me. I could not stop short with the abstractions that usually come to mind when discussing thinking, feeling, and willing. I saw those inner manifestations of life as creative forces, and spiritually they revealed to me, quote, the human being as spirit, unquote. When I then looked at the physical appearance of the human being, I saw it supplemented through the spirit form working within the sensory realm. Thus I arrived at the sensory-suprasensory form Goethe speaks of, which, to true observation, whether physical or spiritual, places itself between the object of the senses and what is perceived spiritually. Step by step, anatomy and physiology pushed toward this sensory-suprasensory form. While this happened, I began to be aware, as yet very imperfectly, of the threefold nature of the human being. Only after I had studied this subject for 30 years did I first mention it publicly in my Riddles of the Soul. What first became clear to me was that where the structure of the human organism is oriented mainly toward the nervous and sensory systems, the sensory-suprasensory form is imprinted most strongly upon the sensory-perceptible. The organization of the head appeared to be the part in which the sensory-suprasensory is most strongly expressed in the physical form. In the organization of the limbs, however, the sensory-suprasensory is most veiled. There the forces of nature outside the human being continue to actively shape the human body. It appeared to me that between these two poles is expressed everything rhythmical, breathing, circulation, and so on. At the time I found no one with whom I could speak of these things. When I occasionally hinted at them, it was viewed with as mere philosophical theory, whereas I knew it was the result of unbiased knowledge of anatomy and physiology based on experience. I found relief from the feeling that I was living in spiritual isolation only when I read and reread the conversation between Goethe and Schiller as they left a meeting of the Society for Scientific Research in Jena. They agreed that nature should not be treated in a piecemeal way as it had just been in the lectures by the botanist Bach. Goethe sketched for Schiller in a few strokes his archetypal plant. It represented the sensory-supersensory form of the plant in its totality, from which leaf, petal, and so on form, thus reproducing the whole within the parts. Schiller, who had not yet overcome his Kantian perspective, was able to see that whole as only an idea created by human reason by observing the details. Goethe could not accept that. He saw the whole spiritually, just as he saw its details physically, and there was no fundamental difference between the spiritual and the physical perception, only a transition from one to the other. He saw clearly that both need to be thought of as belonging to empirical reality. Schiller, however, could maintain only that the archetypal plant is not an experience, but an idea. Goethe, according to his way of thinking, replied, quote, "In that case, I saw my ideas with my eyes." End quote. I felt that I had come to understand these words of Goethe. To me they meant inner peace after a long struggle. I saw that Goethe's view of nature was in accordance with the spirit. This led me to study Goethe's writings on natural science in detail. Initially, it was not my intention to attempt an interpretation of them, as I did soon after in my introduction to Goethe's scientific writings in Kirchner's German National Literature. It was my intention to present independently some field of science, just as that science appeared to me, in accordance with the spirit. Circumstances at the time, however, did not make such an endeavor possible. I had to tutor in very diverse subjects. Quote, "Educationally," unquote, the situations I had to adapt to could not have been more varied. For example, a Prussian officer appeared in Vienna, and for some time he had to leave the German army. He wanted to prepare to join the Austrian army as an officer of engineers. Through a peculiar stroke of destiny, I became his mathematics and science teacher, which deeply satisfied me. My student was an extraordinarily likable man who felt a need for human conversation once we had finished the sessions in mathematics and mechanics required for his preparation. There were similar cases, such as students who had completed their studies and were preparing for a doctoral examination, whom I usually had to coach in mathematics and science. Because of this necessity to repeatedly work through the sciences, I had ample opportunity to become familiar with the current views in this area. When teaching, I could, of course, present only those views, but I had to carry silently within me what, to me, was by far the most essential aspect of knowledge of nature. My work as a private tutor, which was at that time my only possibility of a livelihood, kept me from becoming one-sided. I first had to learn many things before I could teach them. Thus I became familiar with the mysteries of bookkeeping, because I had an opportunity to teach it. I also received fruitful ideas from Schwerer in the area of pedagogy. For years he had been superintendent of the Protestant schools in Vienna. He had written a delightful little book about his experiences, Questions About Teaching, and I had opportunity to discuss it with him. He spoke out often against merely giving information in teaching, and he spoke of the necessity for developing the whole human being. The end of chapter 15. Chapter 16. Destiny brought me a special educational task. I was recommended as tutor to a family with four boys. Three of them required no more than preparatory instruction for elementary school, and later additional tutoring for the middle school. But the fourth boy, who was about 10 years old, was entrusted to me for his entire education. He was a problem for his parents, particularly for his mother. When I came into the family, he had barely acquired the rudiments of reading, writing, and arithmetic. He was considered so abnormal in his physical and mental development that the family doubted that he could be educated at all. His thinking was slow and sluggish, and even slight mental exertion caused a headache, lowered vitality, pallor, as well as alarming emotional behavior. After I had gotten to know the child, I felt certain that an education adapted to this particular soul and bodily constitution would awaken his dormant capacities. And I proposed to the parents that they leave his education in my hands. The boy's mother met my proposal with confidence, and thus I was able to face this task of a special education. I had to find access to a soul that was dormant, as it were, and had to be gradually brought to master the bodily expressions. First, the soul had to be helped to enter the body. I was convinced that the boy had great intellectual capacities, but this was not apparent, and it made my task deeply satisfying. After a short time, I succeeded in gaining the child's love. Merely being with him and communicating with him had the effect of awakening his sleeping soul faculties. I had to devise special methods for teaching him. Even a quarter of an hour over the specified length of time for lessons adversely affected his health. The boy found a relationship to some subjects only with great difficulty. This educational task became a rich source of learning for me. The educational methods I had to adopt gave me insight into how the soul and spirit are connected with the human bodily nature. In fact, it became my training in physiology and psychology. I came to realize that education and teaching must become an art based on true knowledge of the human being. I had to adhere to a carefully planned economical program in order to take the greatest advantage of the boy's intellectual capacities in the shortest possible time. And with the least strain on his mental and physical forces, I often had to spend as much as 2 hours preparing the material I would teach for half an hour. The sequence of the subjects I taught had to be carefully arranged, and the whole day's schedule properly determined. Within 2 years, I had the satisfaction of seeing the boy catch up with the primary school curriculum. He successfully passed the entrance examination for the gymnasium, and his health had improved considerably. His hydrocephalic condition was diminishing quickly. I was able to advise the parents to send the boy to the public school, because I thought it was essential that he grow up with other children. I remained with the family's tutor for several more years, and devoted myself particularly to this boy, whose successful progress through school depended entirely on the fact that at home his activities continued in the same spirit in which they had begun. This was the occasion to which I referred earlier when I continued my study of Greek and Latin, for I had to help this boy and one other in the family with those subjects, because they were required for the gymnasium curriculum. I am grateful that destiny brought me such a circumstance in life. I gained an understanding of human nature in a living, practical way that otherwise would have been barely possible. The family accepted me with exceptional kindness. We came to share a beautiful life together. The boy's father was an agent for Indian and American cotton, and I was able to gain some understanding of the operation of that business and much that was related to it. This was again a great source of learning for me. I looked into the activities of a very interesting branch of the importation business, and could observe transactions between business associates and the connections between various commercial and industrial activities. My charge was successfully helped through gymnasium. I remained with him until the 8th year. By then he had progressed to the degree that he no longer needed my help. After graduating from gymnasium, he entered a school of medicine and became a physician. Serving in that capacity, he was killed in the First World War. The mother, who became a close friend through my work with her son and who always clung to this quote-unquote problem child, was with deep love, died soon after he did. The father had died earlier. Much of my life as a young man was related to this task. For several years, each summer, I went with the family to Attersee in Salzkammergut, where I became familiar with the wonderful alpine nature of Upper Austria. I had continued to give private lessons after assuming this educational task, but was gradually able to pass them on to others, thus allowing me time to pursue my own studies. Before I came to this family, my opportunities to participate in children's games had been limited. Consequently, finally, during my 20s, I had time to play, since I had to learn how to play and direct the games. I did this with great satisfaction. I think that during my life I have played as much as anyone, but it was not until I was between 22 and 28 that I did what is usually accomplished before the age of 10. During this period, I was occupied with the philosophy of Edward von Hartmann. I studied his title, Theory of Knowledge, which continually stirred me to opposition. I was deeply averse to the opinion that the real being of phenomena is beyond the reach of conscious experience, which is alleged to be no more than unreal, image-like reflections of reality. I argued that our conscious experience can reach the true reality through inwardly strengthening the soul life. It was clear to me that the divine spiritual reveals itself in human beings when they make such revelation possible through their inner life. To me, Edward von Hartmann's pessimism seemed to result from asking the wrong questions about human life. I viewed humankind as beings whose goal is to bring what gives their life a satisfactory fulfillment from the wellspring of their own inner nature. I maintained that if the world had been arranged to give us the best possible life to begin with, how could we make this wellspring of creativity flow within us? Good and bad are attributed to external phenomena at a certain stage of world evolution. Only then do human beings awaken to self-awareness and promote evolution, which now attains its freely adopted course, not from created phenomena and facts, but solely from the wellspring of existence itself. To me, even raising the question of pessimism or optimism seemed to be an offense against human freedom. I asked myself, how can human beings freely create their greatest happiness if the external world order provides an allotment of happiness? I felt drawn, nevertheless, to Hartmann's title, Phenomenology of Moral Consciousness. There, Hartmann traces humanity's moral development on the basis of empirical observation. He does not speculate in a way that relates it to an unknown existence beyond the reach of consciousness, as he does in his epistemology and metaphysics. Instead, he considers the manifestation of morality itself. To me, it was clear that no philosophical speculation should go beyond the manifest if it wishes to reach true reality. The phenomena themselves reveal the reality, provided the conscious soul first prepares itself to understand it. One whose consciousness apprehends only what can be seen and experienced physically might imagine that reality must, in fact, exist in a realm beyond the reach of consciousness. But one who also apprehends the spiritual in perception will speak of that spiritual as belonging to this world, not to an epistemological, quote-unquote, beyond. Hartmann's observations about the moral sphere appealed to me, because he allows his views on the beyond to retreat completely, remaining only with what can be observed. I wanted knowledge to be attained not by pondering about what exists behind phenomena, but by entering phenomena themselves, to the extent that they reveal their spiritual nature. Because I always endeavored to appreciate the positive in personal achievement, I valued Edward von Hartmann's philosophy, although I was averse to its fundamental direction and view of life. It did shed penetrating light upon many phenomena. Even in the writings by this, quote, philosopher of the unconscious, unquote, with which I fundamentally disagreed, I found much that was immensely stimulating. This was also true of his popular writings on cultural history, pedagogy, and politics. I found in this pessimist the kind of sound understanding of life that I failed to find in many optimists. I experienced something I needed particularly in relation to Edward von Hartmann, the ability to appreciate even what I had to oppose. I spent many late nights in Ottersee when my boys could be left on their own, and I had admired the starry sky from the balcony, studying title Phenomenology of Moral Consciousness and title The Religious Consciousness of Humankind in Its Gradual Development. As I read those works, I gained more and more certainty of my own epistemological views. The end of chapter 16. Chapter 17. On Schroer's recommendation, I was invited by Joseph Kirchner in 1882 to edit Goethe's writings on natural science, with introductions and explanatory notes. It was to be part of the edition of German national literature. Schröer had been responsible for Goethe's dramas in this great collection, and would write a foreword to the first volume assigned to me. There he defined Goethe's position as poet and thinker in modern culture. Schröer saw a descent from Goethe's spiritual height in the worldview of the scientific age that followed him. His foreword comprehensively characterized my assigned task in editing Goethe's writings on science. For me, this task meant that I had to come to terms with both natural science and Goethe's worldview. As it would be presented to the public, I also had to reach a certain conclusion about what I had attained at that point as my own worldview. Before then, I had written only a few newspaper articles. I did not find it easy to write about what lived in my soul in such a way that I considered it worth publishing. I always felt that whatever had been attained by inner work was largely lost when presented in a finished form. Consequently, all my literary attempts had continued to dissatisfy me inwardly. I found that the dominant trend of scientific thinking, ever since it first began to strongly influence 19th-century civilization, was not adequate to the task of understanding Goethe's work and accomplishments in the area of natural science. His ability to recognize the special spiritual relationship between humankind and the world also enabled him to recognize the true position of science within the larger realm of human achievements. The dominant thinking in the age I grew up in seemed suited only to understanding what is lifeless. In my opinion, that thinking was not strong enough to approach organic nature with the forces of understanding. I told myself that to attain ideas that mediate knowledge of the organic, it is first necessary to bring life into the intellectual concepts that are applied to the inorganic. For me, those ideas appeared dead and consequently were suitable only for understanding what is dead. In order to explain Goethe's view of nature, I attempted to demonstrate how ideas came to life and took shape in Goethe's spirit. What Goethe thought and worked out in relation to various branches of science seemed less significant to me than the central discovery I ascribed to him, his discovery of how one thinks about the organic in order to understand it. I discovered that the mechanical science applied to the inorganic satisfies the human need for knowledge, because rational concepts built up in the human mind are thus realized in lifeless nature. To me, Goethe established a, quote, science of organics, unquote, that relates in the same way to living nature. A study of Galileo within the history of modern spiritual life shows that he gave modern science its characteristic stamp by developing concepts applicable to inorganic matter. What Galileo did for inorganic nature, Goethe attempted to do for organic nature. To me, Goethe is the Galileo of organic nature. My immediate task for Volume 1 of Goethe's scientific writings was to work through his ideas on metamorphosis. I found it difficult to express the relationship between the living, formed idea, through which one can understand the organic, and a formless idea suited to understanding the inorganic. It seemed to me, however, that my whole task depended on making this point absolutely clear. In the process of cognizing the inorganic, concepts are linked together in order to survey the connection of forces affecting nature. When cognizing the organic, one concept must be allowed to grow out of the other, so that in the progressing, living transformation of concepts, images arise that display the being formed in nature. Goethe worked toward this by trying to hold in his mind a pictorial idea of the plant leaf, not a static, lifeless concept, but a concept capable of assuming the most diverse forms. When those forms are allowed to grow from one another, the whole plant could be constructed. Within the soul, one produces as an idea nature's creative, formative process in the actual plant. When attempting to understand the plant in this way, one comes much closer in spirit to natural activity than one can by understanding the inorganic through formless concepts. What one retains from the inorganic is void of spirit and merely a spiritual illusion of what is present in nature. But something lives in the plant's growth that vaguely resembles the image of the plant that arises in the human spirit. One becomes aware that in producing the organic, nature brings about in itself being that corresponds to spirit. In my introduction to Goethe's botanical writings, I wanted to demonstrate that in his theory of metamorphosis, Goethe takes the position that we must think of the activity in organic nature as corresponding to the spirit. And it was Goethe's view that the activity in animals and in the physical foundation of the human being corresponds even more to spirit. Goethe's starting point concerning animals and human beings was his understanding of an error of his contemporaries that he had noticed. By looking for fundamental differences between the human being and the animals, they wanted to assign a special position in nature to the organic foundation of the human being. They believed they had found that difference in the formation of the intermaxillary bone containing the upper incisors in the animal. The human being was thought to lack this special intermediary bone in the upper jaw, which was said to consist of a single part. Goethe felt this was an error. He viewed the human form as a transformation of the animal form to a higher level. Everything that appears in the animal must also be present in the human, but in a higher form that allows the human organism to bear a self-aware spirit. To Goethe, the difference between the human being and the animal is the human's higher form as a whole, not in any particular feature. Ascending in our observations from plant nature to the various animal forms, organic creative forces can be seen as progressively more similar to the spirit. In the organic form of the human being, spiritual formative forces are active that bring the animal form to its highest metamorphosis. These forces are active in the manifestation and growing of the human organism, and are finally expressed as human spirit after they have shaped a vessel in a natural foundation in which they can live free of nature. It seemed to me that this Goethean view of the human organism anticipated everything that was warranted in later assertions of Darwinism concerning the human relationship to animals. But it also seemed to reject everything unwarranted. A materialistic interpretation of Darwin's discoveries led to ideas based on the relationship between human and animal that denied spirit, precisely where it appears in its highest form, in earthly existence, in the human being. An interpretation based on Goethe's view sees the animal structure as a creation of the spirit, but one that has not yet reached the point where spirit as such can live. What lives as spirit in the human creates in the animal form at a preliminary stage. In the human being, this is transformed to the degree that spirit not only manifests as creative, but also as self-experience. In this light, one sees that a Goethean observation of nature, tracing the development from the inorganic to the organic, is a science of nature that leads to a science of spirit. This, above all, is what I wanted to convey when I edited the first volume of Goethe's Natural Scientific Writings. I ended my introduction by showing that Darwinism, colored by materialism, establishes a one-sided view that must be completed by a Goethean way of thinking. In discussing Goethe's organic science, I wanted to demonstrate the way one must cognize in order to understand the phenomena of life. I soon felt that my discussion needed a foundation. The act of cognition, as interpreted by my contemporaries, would never lead to an understanding of Goethe's view. Those epistemologists were influenced by contemporary science. What the sciences had to say about cognition, however, was true only in relation to inorganic nature. There was no agreement between what I had to say of Goethe's way of knowing and the usual contemporary epistemologies. What I said about Goethe's organic science again drove me to the problem of epistemology. I confronted views like those of Otto Liebmann. Liebmann's views in various ways expressed the opinion that human consciousness can never go beyond itself, but must remain content to live in whatever reality sends to the human soul, and whatever presents itself spiritually within. This interpretation makes it impossible to say, as Goethe did, that something related to spirit can be found in organic nature. Spirit is thus seen only within human consciousness. Any consideration of nature in terms of spirit is inadmissible. I found that no epistemology for a Goethean knowledge existed. This discovery made me at least attempt to outline such an epistemology, titled My Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception, was written because of an inner need before I began my work on further volumes of Goethe's natural scientific writings. This book was completed in 1886. The end of chapter 17. Chapter 18. While I was working on title A Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception, destiny led me to a family in whose circle I was privileged to spend many delightful hours and a happy chapter of my life. One of my friends of long standing was a young man whom I found particularly congenial because of his fresh, sunny disposition, his unerring comments on life and human beings, and above all his loyalty and straightforwardness. I was invited to his home along with other mutual friends. There we met his sisters, the two daughters of the family, and a young man soon to be engaged to the oldest daughter. Behind the scenes of this family one sensed the presence of something unknown to us, the father of the siblings. He was there, and yet not there. We heard about the unknown one in the most varied ways. From what was said, he seemed to be an exceptional person. Initially, the brother and sisters never spoke of their father, though he must have been in the next room. Finally, they made various remarks about him. Every word was spoken with true reverence. One felt that they honored their father as a significant person, yet that they also felt anxious that we might see him. We usually discussed literature in the circle of that family, and many books were retrieved from their father's library. Thus I gradually became acquainted with much of what the man in the next room read, though I never met the man himself. Finally, I could not help asking numerous questions about the unknown one. Things that the brother and sister said with reserve were nevertheless revealing. Gradually a picture arose within me of this peculiar person. I loved the man, who also seemed significant to me. I came to respect him as one whom the destiny of hard experiences had led to occupy himself inwardly with the world, and as well as to avoid all contact with others. One day we were told he was ill, and soon after that he died. The brother and sister entrusted the funeral address to me. In it I said what my heart prompted me to say about this man whom I knew only in the way I described. No one was present at the funeral except the family, the fiancée of the elder daughter, and my friends. The brother and sister said that I gave a true picture of their father in the funeral address. Their words and tears told me that they really meant it. Indeed, I knew that the man was as close to me in spirit as if I'd had extensive contact with him. A beautiful friendship gradually developed between the younger daughter and myself. This young woman was somewhat the archetypal German maiden. There was no artifice in her. There was a simple, sweet naturalness combined with inner reserve. Her reserve called up a similar reserve in me. We loved each other, and both of us knew this. Neither of us, however, could overcome our shyness in order to say that we loved each other. Consequently, our love lived in between our spoken words, but never in them. I felt our relation as a very intimate friendship of soul, but I found it impossible to reach out beyond that soul realm. I was happy in this friendship. She was like a ray of sunshine in my life. Yet this very life later parted us. Happy hours spent together gave place to a short-lived correspondence, after which only the sad memory of a beautiful chapter remained, a memory that has risen ever since, again and again, from the depths of my soul. Meanwhile, during a visit to Schröer, I found him totally inspired by an impression he had just received. He had become acquainted with the writings of Marie Eugenie Delle Grazie. She had published a small volume of poems, an epic titled Hermann, a drama titled Saul, and a story, quote, The Gypsy, unquote. Schröer spoke about them with enthusiasm. He had said, quote, they were written by a young person not yet 16 years of age, unquote, and added that Robert Zimmermann had declared her to be the only real genius he had ever met. Schröer's enthusiasm immediately led me to read, all at once, everything she had written. Later I wrote an article about that poet, which resulted in the great pleasure of meeting her. I have often recalled our conversation at that time. She had embarked upon a major task, her epic titled Robespierre. She spoke of the basic ideas of this poem. Even then, a fundamentally pessimistic mood sounded through her words. It seemed to me that her disposition made her wish to represent in a figure such as Robespierre the tragedy of all idealism. To her, the ideals that arise in the human heart are powerless against the senseless, cruel, and destructive effect of nature, a nature that cries out mercilessly to all idealism. Quote, "You are merely an illusion, a creature of my own fantasy, which again and again I hurl back into nothingness," unquote. This was Della Grazzi's conviction, and she spoke to me about another poetic work, titled Satanide. She wanted to portray the opposite image of God, a primordial being and power revealed to human beings in cruel, senseless, crushing nature. She spoke with true brilliance about this power, who, from the abyss of existence, dominates all existence. I left her deeply shaken. The greatness with which she had spoken remained with me. The substance of her ideas was the antithesis of everything that presented itself to my spirit as a worldview. I was never inclined, however, to hold back my admiration and interest from whatever I considered great, even when I absolutely opposed it. Indeed, I felt that such contrasts in the world are certainly reconciled somewhere. And this feeling enabled me to enter with understanding whatever I opposed, as if it were congenial to my own views. Soon afterward, I was invited to Della Grazzi's. She was to read from title Robespierre to a number of people, including Schroer, his wife, and a woman friend of the couple. We listened to scenes described with great poetic ardor, but fundamentally pessimistic and richly colored by naturalism. It depicted life in its most shattering aspects. Great men, utterly deceived by fate, rose before our imagination and sank away in deeply stirring tragedy. This was my impression. Schroer was indignant. In his view, art should not delve into such a, quote, bottomless abyss of horror, unquote. The ladies withdrew. They were in a state of inner turmoil. But I could not agree with Schroer. To me, he seemed swayed by his feeling that poetry should not describe the terrible tragedies a human soul may experience, even though the terror be real. Soon after, a poem by Della Grazzi appeared, extolling nature as the highest power, but a nature scornful of every ideal she herself invokes for the sole purpose of deluding the human being, and which she once again throws back into nothingness once the delusion has succeeded. With this poem in mind, I wrote an article, quote, Nature and Our Ideals, unquote. Although I did not publish it, I did have a limited number of copies printed. I wrote in that article about the apparent justification of Della Grazzi's view. I said that, in my opinion, a view that does not deny nature's inherent enmity against human ideals is higher than shallow optimism that fails to acknowledge the abysses of existence. I mentioned also, however, the free inner human being that creates out of itself meaning and substance for life, and that would not develop if outer nature extravagantly provided externally what should be created from within. This article brought me a great sorrow. When Schroer received it, he wrote to me that, if this was my view of pessimism, we had never understood each other. He said that one who could speak of nature as I did in my article proved he was unable to consider seriously enough Goethe's words, quote, "Know yourself and live at peace with the world," unquote. These words, from the very person with whom I felt so strong a kinship, hurt deeply. Schroer could be passionately agitated when he sensed a sin against the harmonious beauty of art. He turned away from Della Grazzi because he believed he saw this error in her, and he viewed my admiration for the poet as a withdrawal from him as well as from Goethe. He failed to recognize what I said in my article about the human spirit overcoming the hindrances of nature from within. He was hurt because I maintained that the external world could not create true inner satisfaction for the human being. I wanted to demonstrate the meaninglessness of pessimism despite its justification within certain limits. But Schroer saw in every inclination toward pessimism what he called, quote, "the mere slag of burned-out genius," unquote. The end of chapter 18, and the end of this section of the reading.